linguistic objects.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. So, I hope you haven't been too worried about why there hasn't been a podcast from the salon for a couple of weeks. Had everything gone according to my plan, this would be, about my third podcast since the previous one. However, the fates had something else in store for me as I came down with the flu. So for the past 2 weeks or so, I've more or less been flat on my back in bed, on and off. While I was laying there, I got to thinking that I probably need some way to signal you that all is well and that the podcast would soon be coming out once again. But I wasn't able to think of a way to do it. So I guess that if you don't hear from me for a bit and I haven't told you that I'd be offline for a while, well, then it's probably safe to assume that I'm sick. Which means that if you don't hear from me for a while, well, don't worry, I'm just sick. I haven't quit doing the podcast. And for what it's worth, I'm finally starting to feel a little bit like I'm on the road to recovery again. Now, before I do anything else, I want to be sure to thank those generous saloners who have sent donations in during the past 2 weeks. And they include Beyond the Circles of Time, Andrew K., Jason T., Tim H., and a very generous donation from Alicia, who you'll be hearing from in the not-too-distant future, because John Hanna sent me a care package the other day that included 3 plialogs from last summer's Burning Man Festival, and Alicia's talk about the future of psychedelic research was one of them. So a big thank you goes out to Alicia and to all of our other donors who are helping to keep these podcasts coming to you. With our ever-increasing use of bandwidth and CPU cycles, our monthly hosting costs are now up to about $50 a month. But thanks to our donors, including some carry forward from last year, we've already got next month covered. Now I'd better get on with today's program before my energy fades and I have to take another nap. I have to admit that the irony of this situation hasn't been lost on me. As you know, for 2 years now, I've resisted playing any talks by Dr. Timothy Leary. Basically, I've done that out of respect for 2 close friends of mine who worked with Dr. Leary in the 60s, and both of whom who now have a rather low opinion of the good doctor. So now that I've finally changed my position and decided to podcast a talk by him, what happens? Well, I get too sick to produce the show. It's obviously just a coincidence, but a humorous one, I have to admit. So why have I changed my mind about podcasting Tim Leary, you ask? Well, a couple of weeks ago, I received a package in the mail from my friend Bruce Damer, who has been working with some of the people involved in trying to get the Leary archive properly placed in a university library setting. And this package consisted of a hard drive that contained over 50 gigabytes of audio and video from the Leary archives. And what a treasure trove it is, I have to tell you. And so that you don't think that I'm going to keep all of this to myself, I should mention that as soon as I get this podcast online, I'll be adding all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon to the hard drive that Bruce sent me, and he named it the Pod, by the way, and I'll be putting it in the mail to the good folks at the Internet Archive, where the material will eventually become available to anyone who wants to use it. For our purposes here in the salon, I'm going to focus, at least for now, on some of the more historic talks from this archive in the interest of keeping all of our fellow saloners up to date on the history of our tribe. Because if we don't know our history, we run the risk of not knowing where we're going or why we're heading in a particular direction. So now for a little history about Dr. Leary. And I've learned that when it comes to Timothy Leary, the crowd often splits 3 ways. Those who knew him in the 60s and are still unhappy with his behavior. Those who knew him during the last decade or so of his life and who now think of him as St. Timothy. And by far the largest group are those who have no idea of who he was or why we should care. Yeah, you heard me correctly. The vast majority of our fellow saloners most likely don't even know who Dr. Timothy Leary actually was. My guess is that if you're over 50 years old, you have a very clear idea of the impact he had on American life in the 60s. And during the next few months, I'll be playing a few selections from the Leary Archive that should put this era in a little better perspective for you, mainly because I think it might help us all get a little better perspective on our current times, which are equally exciting and important, more so if you ask me. But now that I think about it, the task of explaining who Tim Leary was is going to take a lot more time and energy than I'm up for right now. I do think it's important for the psychedelic community to know something about our immediate history, but I'm going to have to count on you to go to Wikipedia and get a little background information about him on your own. Instead, I'll just try to give you a brief idea of the context for the talk you're about to hear. To begin with, it was given at the Cooper Union, which has been an important intellectual forum here in the States for quite a while. In fact, Cooper Union was where Abraham Lincoln gave his first and probably his most famous anti-slavery speech. So it was to this hallowed spot that the good Dr. Leary was to give what may have been his first major public talk about a substance called LSD. It was in late November of 1964, and at the time, I'm quite certain that not only did the vast majority of people in this country not know what LSD was, we still hadn't even heard about a place called Vietnam. The 50s still had their steely grip on American culture, and rock and roll was actually being banned in many places across the land. At the time Dr. Leary took the stage in New York City that night, John Kennedy had been dead for merely 1 year. The Beatles had only made their first appearance in the States a few months before that. Segregation was still the law of the land. And the Vietnam War hadn't even made it to the front pages of our newspapers yet. It was sort of like the lull before the storm. So it is the talk that we're about to hear, at least from my perspective, that may actually have been the opening salvo of what we now call the 60s, because in addition to the 1,000 or so people in the audience that night, this talk was also broadcast on the radio. And so it was that LSD finally began to enter into the consciousness of mainstream America. Now let's join the chairman of the Cooper Union Forum as he introduces Dr. Timothy Leary. And listen to ourselves as the revolution in consciousness that we call the 60s got off to its start.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Cooper Union Forum. This is your chairman, Johnson E. Fairchild, speaking to you from the great hall of the Cooper Union, where we are continuing with our program on the search for mental health. For the benefit of our radio audience, this was done deadpan, believe me. Our subject for discussion is hallucinogenic drugs or how to use your head. And our speaker is Dr. Timothy Leary, clinical psychologist, who, among other things, just got off an airplane about an hour ago. Personally, I'm so happy that he got off it an hour ago, otherwise I would have had a done it. In any event, Dr. Leary, who had his origins in New England, believe it or not, been educated in Alabama, Washington, and his doctor's degree from the University of California. He has been in clinical psychology, Veterans Administration, resident assistant to Kaiser Foundation Hospital in Oakland, California. And he has had numerous lectures and activities. Been at Harvard University, 1959 to 1963. He is present director of the Castalia Foundation. Believe it or not, he was at Harvard. And director of the Castalia Foundation. He has done a great deal of work in this general field. He is author of Psychedelic Experience and also 27 essays and articles on psychedelic drugs. And frankly, as director of adult education, I'm very happy to welcome Mr. Timothy Leary to the Cooper Union Forum, speaking on hallucinogenic drugs or how to use your head. Mr. Leary.
This lecture on how to use your head could be summed up in one sentence. You have to go out of your mind to use your head. Now, with that, I should go home, but there's a 58-minute radio tape that has to be filled, so I'll go on for a little more time. My aim tonight is to try to present the most important message you've ever heard. Now, this aim, quixotic as it may seem, is to change your view of man and maybe your view of yourself. I know it sounds grandiose, but this aim is not, because it's nothing new. We're going to be talking about the oldest problem, the oldest mystery which man has faced. And what I'm going to say, again, is the oldest message in human history. Now, this lecture could be given in hundreds of metaphorical, literary, philosophic, scientific languages. I'm going to try tonight, though, to present this story in terms of a mystery novel, a detective story, because I think that it's the greatest scientific, philosophic mystery story in history. And it all has to do with an incredible robbery, the greatest confidence game in history, the greatest loss of treasure that we can conceive of, the most successful cosmic swindle, and the victims, you and I, don't even know we've been robbed, or maybe have only the dimmest suspicion that something has happened to us. Let me describe the incredible nature of the crime. At birth, the human being is presented with an extraordinarily valuable gift, an instrument magical and intricate and powerful beyond belief, a camera with literally billions of lenses. I'm talking, of course, about the human brain. Neurologists tell us that the brain contains between 10 and 13 billion nerve cells. Now, of course, that's a ridiculous statistic. The human mind just can't grapple with the concept 10 billion. But to make matters worse, neurologists tell us that any one brain cell can be hooked up with as many as 25,000 other cells. So that what you're dealing with is a matrix, a network, a computer, the number of associations of which again, are stupendous. We're told that the number of possible associations in the human brain at any one second is larger than the number of atoms in the universe. Neurologists tell us that the human brain fires off about 5,000 million signals a second. there's a tremendous amount of activity going on in the 7 inches behind our forehead. There's a tremendous amount of information and a tremendous amount of awareness going on there. Your brain is aware of several thousand activities going on in your kidney at every 1 second. It's aware of what's going on in your liver. It's processing the most incredible kinds of chemical information, pH content, blood levels, sugar levels, oxygen, CO2. Your brain is aware of this enormous amount of information. But we, that is, I, Timothy Leary, and each one of you is cut off, of course, from awareness of most of these processes. Now, the gap between what the mind is aware of and the limits of consciousness within our head is the robbery that I mentioned before. Almost every culture and every religion has some way of explaining how we lost this. And most cultures and most religions have some theories as to how to get it back. The Christian theology tells us that we lost it because of the sins of our forefathers. Eastern philosophies tell us that it's there inside and we can get it back, and that most of the things we see going on outside are maya, or processes that tend to pull us in to external awareness and preventing us from enjoying and understanding this fantastic kaleidoscopic series of activities within. And almost every religion has produced a method for expanding consciousness or for recapturing what we've lost. According to the monotheistic religions, the Judeo-Christian and Islamic theories, there's a judge up there that will give it back to us if we follow his book and do what his lawyers tell us to do. Eastern religions and Eastern psychologies have, of course, a wide variety of methods for expanding consciousness, for getting back the potentials which we've lost. And even most primitive cultures have developed some sort of myths, heroic sagas, which suggest how man has tried to recover the lost treasure. Now, in taking this eccentric position of taking the brain seriously, you run the risk of getting out of touch with your professional colleagues. But there are some comforts, because you're admitted to another club, which is one of the oldest scientific and philosophic associations in history, which has been going on for centuries and for thousands of years. The long line of people who have had some suspicion that there's a lot more than we've been led to believe. Now, the present time is a very exciting time for the members of this club, because there have been 3 developments very recently in science which have suggested new metaphors, new ways of explaining this mystery, and new methods for rediscovering the lost treasure. These three developments are, first, the recent findings about the genetic code. Second, and more important for us who are alive today, the research on the process of imprinting, which is the way the nervous system is structured early in the life of any species. And third, the development of the psychedelic drugs. I want to talk about the genetic code and its implications for the expansion of consciousness. We're focusing here on the question, why did we lose access to all this consciousness which resides within, and who did it? And I'm going to suggest, for metaphorical purposes, that the genetic code, which has so designed the nervous system as to rob man, temporarily, of access to his own head. Now, of course, the first thing you have to do in cracking a mystery is to put yourself in the place of the criminal. You have to find the motive for the crime. So I'm going to ask you to think with me as to what the genetic code's game is. Now, of course, this has always been a very impious thing to do. When man tries to figure out what God's game is, or when the human mind, which is a fragment of the nervous system, attempts to figure out what the genetic blueprint is up to, because it's the genetic blueprint which designed and produced the brain and the mind that's trying to figure it out. So we're in a ridiculous position, but let's try it. Now, from the standpoint of the strategy of the genetic material, every living species is simply a creative solution to a packaging problem. Every single-celled organism, every lower form of life, every fish in the sea, every form of vegetation, every mammal, including man, is an original design, a packaging design, to meet the particular environmental problems that that species faces in the air, under the earth, in the water, on land. Now, when you get to the more complicated forms of life like mammals, the packaging problem is really incredible, because the mammalian body, or the human body, is an enormously intricate machine to get this simple task done. Now, the genetic code, as I imagine it to operate, faces a very tricky problem here. And here's the problem. In order to get the, in order to keep the mammalian body going, you have to have a nervous system which coordinates and registers all the information that's going on inside this incredible machine and outside around us. The brain has to be aware of billions of events which occur from moment to moment. But the pilot of this seed, this mobile seed carrying package, obviously can't be tuned in on all of this activity, because if you and I were aware of this kaleidoscope of events inside, we'd be so ecstatic, we'd be so engulfed, we'd be so amazed, we'd be so delighted that we'd simply stand still and never move in wonder and awe and ecstasy, and we wouldn't pilot our package through the jungles of New York to keep the genetic code's game going. So you see the strategy. Somehow, there has to be a pilot stuck way, way, way up in a crow's nest. Thinks he has a very important role in the whole operation, but actually down below there's this enormous ship with this mobile factory moving along, which really pays no attention to what's going on in the crow's nest. The reason that the human mind is cut off from most of the brain's activity seems to have logical, strategic meaning to the problem that the genetic code faces. And this, I suggest, is the why of the great neurological robbery. Next, I want to discuss the how of the robbery. The way the genetic code solves this problem is through the process of imprinting. And this is the second great discovery of the last 15 years, which we're convinced may well change man's view of himself. Now, the research on imprinting has been done by scientists called ethologists. These are men who study animal behavior and animal learning in the very early hours of the organism's history. And they've come up with some remarkably interesting findings in the last few years. The first finding is that very early, in the first hours or the first days of almost every bird and mammal species, is what's called a critical period. This is a period when the nervous system seems to be sensitive and vulnerable and open to registering certain environmental events and imprinting them. This critical period, which has been fairly well studied for many species, ends, and after the critical period, the process of imprinting can no longer take place. Now, let me give you an example. In the case of most birds, let's take, for example, ducks. The duck, usually the baby duck, usually imprints the first object that moves and makes noise. And any object which moves and makes noise during the critical period will then be followed, and all of the instinctual machinery inside the duck's body will then be focused on this first imprinted object. Now, of course, in almost every case, the first moving object that makes noise that the baby duck experiences is the mother. And that's great because the baby duck imprints the adult of its species and then is hooked on the duck game. But if you remove the mother duck before the critical period, which I think in the case of ducks last, say, between the 12th and 20th hour of the baby's life, if you remove the mother and substitute any other object which moves and makes noise, the duck will imprint that. One of the most amusing and somewhat horrifying studies which have been done by ethologists is that baby ducks were presented during this critical period with a large, round, orange basketball, which led to the pathetic picture of the baby ducklings following the basketball as it was pulled or towed around the room. To test whether it has taken place, you repeat the imprinting sequence after the critical period. In this case, the baby duck was put in a Y maze, and on the left-hand part of the Y maze was a nice, round, fluffy mother duck, and on the right arm of the Y maze was an orange basketball. the ducks were imprinted on the basketball, took one look at the mother duck, and followed the orange basketball. This is both funny and tragic because it raises the question, in the case of the human being, what accidental orange basketballs have you and I been exposed to early in life? Now, there's one fascinating aspect of imprinting, which is tremendously relevant to the psychedelic experience, and for that matter, to other interpretations of the psychedelic experience, like the religious, and that is that imprinting has to do with external objects. And the trick of the genetic code in setting up the strategy of imprinting was to get our attention on things out there, and on one particular thing out there. Then, of course, once you imprint something, once you imprinted your orange basketball, then the process of learning, which psychologists study, took over, conditioning, so that first there was the orange basketball, and then you found that the orange basketball had a bottle, and then you knew that every time you heard footsteps on the floor, the orange basketball was there with the bottle. And slowly, step by step, through conditioning, reinforcement learning, so forth, you built up the very complicated structure that you now have as a socialized human being. The suggestion is that this all started, was based on an original imprinting experience, an irreversible biochemical process engraved on your nervous system. Now, the science of imprinting is getting quite complicated, and I'm always tempted to go into imprinting experiments because they have such tremendous relevance for the human situation. You see, if you keep the baby duck in a dark box during this critical period, after the 20th hour, if you take the box out, the baby duck will just wander around aimlessly and will open up its beak to be fed at any noise, will try to copulate it when it gets older with any moving object. It's helpless in a survival sense. There's some evidence from human beings, although there's been almost no scientific studies in printing, that little babies who have had no human object around during the early hours develop into what's called childhood schizophrenics. That is, they can never get any contact with a human being. And when human beings try to contact these little babies, it's just like the mother duck attempting to contact that little baby duck that is off following a basketball. A most eerie and disturbing experience to watch. Now, according to the ethologists, imprinting is a biochemical engraving of the nervous system which is irreversible. From the standpoint of the genetic code plays the game of statistics with us. It knows that in most cases we will imprint adults in our species, and then if we model ourselves and learn from that imprinted object, the chance that we'll grow up to be like our parents, who are successful enough from the standpoint of the genetic code that they had us, and so the game can keep going. But the most relevant point for our discussion tonight is that once this imprinting has taken place, the nervous system has been frozen. There's that snapshot of the duck, and you can be conditioned to relate other things to that orange basketball, but general feeling is that imprinting is irreversible. Of course, there's one other disturbing thing about imprinting. I'm convinced that if you ask the baby duck, "Now, come on, why is it that you chase that cold plastic basketball when you could chase that nice fluffy mother duck?" The duck would probably have 31 good logical rational reasons why. You know, after all, orange is a nicer color, and then there's no, it's more, it's cleaner. You can't get venereal disease. keep the birth rate down. At times it seems to us that one of the functions of the mind is to rationalize and protect an accidental early imprint. Another interesting aspect of imprinting is that it can be affected, postponed, delayed, influenced by drugs. For example, reserpine can postpone period of imprinting if baby ducks are kept or baby birds are kept on reserpine. Then, long after the time when the critical period is over, imprinting can take place. This, of course, has implications for other drug approaches to this problem. I'm suggesting then that imprinting is the method that the genetic code uses to focus the attention of the pilot of this mobile seed-carrying package on certain aspects of the environment which statistically will teach it how to survive. But what this means is that the genetic code has preempted about 99.999% of your brain and my brain for its purposes and has left us with this 0.00001% for us to play out our chessboard on. Aldous Huxley has a very interesting thing to say about that. He made the comment that he finds it amusing and altogether admirable that 99% of his brain didn't know that Aldous Huxley existed. Having suggested the why and the how of this neurological robbery, I want to move next to what we think is the new solution. Now, of course, imprinting is simply a term. It's a metaphor. What we ask of any metaphor or any theory in science is, first of all, how much of the data or how many different findings, how many different fields does it tie together? The imprinting metaphor is interesting because it ties together ethology, neurology, pharmacology, and we think psychology. The second thing you ask of any metaphor or any new theory is how practical is it? And as I hope to point out later, we think there are very practical implications of the imprinting theory for man's use of his head. We suggest that psychedelic drugs may be seen as chemical agents which temporarily suspend your old imprint. That is, we think that most of us go through life interpreting and experiencing everything in terms of some very tired old snapshots which were imposed upon us maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago. And the job of our mind is to relate every new experience in life to some object or some person on that tired old snapshot, so that every new woman you meet is usually seen in terms of a chain of other women back to whatever woman was in your original imprint, if you were lucky to have a woman in it. Now, there are many reasons why we think that it's useful to conceive of the psychedelic drugs as suspenders of imprinting. And one of them has to do with this commitment, attachment of the imprinting process to the external. Because there's one thing that happens during an LSD session is that you tend to lose a lot of your attachment to external events. It's perfectly typical that during an LSD session, the subject will lie for 5 or 6 hours completely silently, not moving around, and perhaps even with their eyes closed, which has led in the past some psychiatrists to say, aha, LSD causes catatonic stupors. But then when you ask the person what was going on during that 5 or 6 hours when you didn't move, were you in a stupor or a coma? And the person would say, coma? More was going on any 1 second of that period than in any month of my life before. The point is, and this, of course, is the tricky point, that the commitment to the external orange basketball is temporarily lost, which can be an ecstatic liberation, or it can be a terrorizing paranoia, depending upon how much you understand about the possibilities of your mind. Now, there's another interesting line of evidence which kind of focuses in here, and this is the evidence from a line of study of psychologists last few years, which is called sensory deprivation. The word sensory deprivation is an amusing one, because what psychologists mean by sensory deprivation, that word deprivation is a tricky one, is that if you put a person in a dark room where there's not any noise or any stimulation, and you keep him there for several hours, after this period of time, strange things begin to happen. He begins to have hallucinations. He begins to develop paranoias. Or he begins having a wonderful time. Of course, most of these studies have been done with Air Force pilots or very outgoing Americans. And when they're separated from their orange basketball for more than 1 hour... when they're separated from their orange basketball for more than 1 hour, they begin to bang their heads against the wall. On the other hand, what sensory deprivation is, of course, is one of the oldest techniques of getting out of your mind, to use your head, which has ever been known. The monastic cell, the monk in the desert, the yoga who turns off the external world, and so forth. So the same phenomena which to an American psychologist causes psychosis, to most of the rest of the world is seen as one of the royal roads to using your head. And there's an amusing story about Gerald Hurd, the 70-year-old British philosopher, who's a tiny little man, who went running around the country several years ago looking for a psychiatric research center where he could jump in one of these sensory deprivation vats and take LSD and use his head. Now, so far, the notions of imprinting and psychedelic drugs may be interesting, but the implications are not terribly dramatic. When I present this theory to psychiatrists, they would say, yes, that makes logical sense, but we could say the same thing in psychoanalytic terms, that you work the chain of associations back to the original traumatic event or the original primal scene, and then the task is, of course, to understand that and do something about it. The way the analysts do it is they try to get back to the original imprint, and then by having you fall in love with the analyst, you try to build up another imprint. I'm not saying that critically. I think that the Freudian theory, the psychoanalytic theory of free association to get back to the original event, and the transference neurosis to get out of that or get a new imprint, is one of the most brilliant models ever developed by man, and I'm really breathless in admiration. And the more I understand about imprinting, the shrewder and the more creative I see that Freud was. He was a brilliant man. But the thing which excites us these days is the corollary concept of psychedelic re-imprinting. Now, this is a very complicated and promising notion. Our concept of the brain at present is that you and I have been presented at birth with this 13 billion cell camera with the possibilities of shooting motion pictures all the time. But because of the genetic code and imprinting, we've been frozen with one snapshot. We think that the psychedelic drugs can suspend the old snapshot, and anyone who's had LSD will perhaps empathize that I describe someone's experience as your neurological camera tumbling in a million different directions any half hour, shooting all sorts of film that you had never thought possible before, and then very slowly, over a period of 8 or 10 or 11, 12 hours, slowing down and eventually coming to rest, maybe after 16 hours. But we think that you come to rest with a new snapshot. Now, there's nothing that I'm saying about imprinting or LSD or re-imprinting which is either positive or negative. I'm not here to sell LSD or to sell you on your brain. The more you think about the psychedelic experience in terms of neurological photography, you see that you can take beautiful pictures or you can take miserable pictures. You can take frightening pictures, you can take holy pictures, you can take any kind of pictures. So that the challenge for psychedelic research at this point is to learn how to use this incredible camera and to learn about lighting, what kind of objects you want to take pictures of, and so forth. Now, it's obvious, too, that you don't lose your old imprint, because after an LSD session, you come back and you still speak English and you know how to lace your shoes. As a matter of fact, that's one of the problems, that too often we go back too readily to the old orange basketball with all its correlated habits. And one of the paradoxes that intrigued us at the beginning of our research 4.5 years ago was, why is it that for 8 hours a person can be shooting up there in all sorts of cosmic revelations, great Buddha enlightenments, and then the next day we're back in the same old neurological straitjacket? Well, I think this is easily explained, that the original orange basketball that you and I imprinted then, through conditioning, built up around it hundreds of thousands or millions of associations, so that all our language, all of our rituals, all of our behaviors, and so forth, are connected with the original imprint. Whereas if a man and his wife take LSD at sunset on their honeymoon, they take a wonderful new picture, but the problem and the challenge is that, of course, they don't stay in that situation, but tend to drift back to the old habits, because there are no new habits, or take a long time to build up habits around a new imprint. Now, everything that we have learned and thought about re-imprinting in relationship to psychedelic drugs has led us to increase the cautions that we make about LSD. It's a very tricky proposition. And before, when we thought that a psychedelic session just lasted 12 hours and gave you a new view, but then brought you back, we took chances in sessions that, by hindsight now, we think are quite reckless, because we think every time you have a psychedelic experience, there's a possibility of taking new pictures, which may be quite different from your old pictures. And you should be very careful with whom you take LSD and where you take LSD, and you should be very well prepared, because you're likely to come out of the session, of course, with a purple-colored football. Which may or may not cause problems when you go back to the office the next day, which is filled with orange basketballs. Now that the cautions have been presented, I feel it's possible to say something about the potentialities or the promises of this theory. If someone gave you a very valuable camera, how often would you use it? Or when would you use it? This, of course, is the question. How do you use your head? How often are you going to use your head? How often are you going to take LSD? we often use the concept of serial reimprinting, and that one concept of man's existence, which might well take hold in the future, is that you have this neurological camera. You obviously should use it any time you're changing your environment, any time you're taking a new job, any time you're moving into a new neighborhood, any time you're changing your interpersonal network, any time you have a new occupational task that you want to have engraved and not connected to your basketball by a series of associations. Anytime you have some important change in your life, you want to take a new snapshot. You don't want to take that old, tired picture from the 10 or 15 years past and apply it in a new situation. Of course, there's a paradox here, because the question, how often should you reprogram your nervous system? How often should you take LSD? It's your present robot snapshot identity which is deciding when it's going to change itself. And this accounts, I think, for the fear and the hesitation which almost all of us feel about a psychedelic drug session. I think that anyone who doesn't experience at some moment during their psychedelic session an intense, awful fear has been cheated by their psychiatrist or their bootlegger. One way of deciding how often to take LSD in this utopian world of the future is not to let your mind decide, because I'm suggesting that the genetic code wants our mind to be attached to externals and shuns the internal. Rather than letting your mind decide, why not let your body decide? And here's a fascinating aspect of the pharmacology of LSD. You can't take LSD every day. That is, you can't keep your neurological camera just going in this kaleidoscopic fashion for more than 12 or 15 or 20 hours. There's what's called a refractory period. That if you take LSD today, you have to wait 5, 6, 7, or 8 days before you can have another psychedelic effect. In other words, if you suspend your snapshot, it takes maybe 5 or 6 days to let the new snapshot kind of harden, and it's 5 or 6, 7 days before you're back in a new robot situation, and then the nervous system is ready for another reprogramming. So that it may well be in the utopian world of the future that LSD and similar foods and chemicals will be used just as vitamins are used today. And it's possible that every 7 days you'll take LSD and bring your picture up to date. Now, the time is running out for the radio program, and I'm going to rush to the conclusions. There are other things which can be taken up in the question period that I wanted to talk about. The conclusions that we've come to after 4.5 years of psychedelic research is that we know almost nothing about our own heads or how to use them. And anyone who tells you he knows much about LSD, of course he's really talking about the potentialities of his brain, should be listened to with great caution. Because the human species at this time is a very primitive species, which has just got this cortex only 40,000 years ago, and we're just now catching on to the possibility that we can use it. And so it's going to take several thousand years, I think, before we'll have any clue as to how really to use this incredible machine. But conclusion number one is... Thank you. Are you a pessimist or an optimist? Conclusion number one is that the members of our research group have lost a lot of our zeal to proselytize about the human brain or to run large research projects or to get involved in any external politics which would attempt to raise money for research grants or to get LSD accepted by the FDA and so forth. Your main job and my main job is to save your own head and to save, to learn how to use your head and learn how to use my head. Or to use the religious metaphor, the real task is to save your own soul and for me to save my own soul. Because the trap is always to get caught in external programs, movements, publications, research grants, and so forth. The problem is always inside. And of course, this is the oldest message of that man has ever told himself. There's a second conclusion, and that is that there seems to be a duty to report back for those who have been engaged in internal explorations. It's only fair, since we're all in the dark anyway, to share any landmarks or any points of interest that can be used for other travelers. And of course, that's what's been happening for centuries. And in our psychedelic research, we have relied on many maps drawn by men who made these voyages thousands of years ago. This book, The Psychedelic Experience, is based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is an eminently practical LSD guide, although it's 2,500 years old. The third conclusion is that as you detach yourself from so complete an investment in external gains, you come to appreciate your own body more, and the natural process more. I should clarify that we talk so much about the brain that once someone listened to us said that the more we talked about the brain, she got the picture of my forehead getting higher and higher and my cranium swelling, so that pretty soon it was this tiny little tendril of a body with this huge computer, 13 billion cell camera on top. This is quite the opposite of what we mean, that those who have worked with psychedelic drugs know that you become more and more aware of the infinity of possibilities within your own body and less obsessively concerned with some externals, which seem irrelevant. Another conclusion is, I think it's suggested by my early remarks, there's less and less interest in broad mass public activity and much more commitment to primary groups, family groups, close small groups of friends. Although the histories would have us think that all the important events in man's life are elections and wars and this sort of thing, you know and I know that all the meaningful things in our life take place in private and with either one other person or a very small group of people. It's always been that way. It's always been that way, and there's never going to be a large, federally supported research grant on psychedelics, which is going to learn to teach you how to use your head or help me solve my spiritual problems. Let's not kid ourselves. Another conclusion is that, and here I can't generalize, I'm talking about the 30 or 40 people with whom I've been associated in this work. There's a much deeper appreciation for one of the oldest and most basic of human enterprises, and that is the male-female relationship. LSD is the most powerful aphrodisiac ever known to man. Now, it's interesting, some clapped and some didn't. Let me explain what an aphrodisiac is. Aphrodisiac comes from the Greek word for the goddess of love. An aphrodisiac is an agent which promotes love. And by aphrodisiac, I don't mean faster and more motions of robot bodies in bedrooms. I'm, of course, talking about the communication which can exist between people whose neurological cameras are accelerated and much wider and more open. In the future utopian society I've been talking about, a wife may be a little bit worried if her husband has an illicit sexual affair, but real grounds for divorce will be if he takes LSD with another woman. So here, the mystery comes full circle. Because the paradox is that the more you use your head, the more in tune we think you get with the original purpose and design and goal of the genetic code. Because if there's anything the genetic code seems to want, it's to keep itself going. To keep the great game of life going. For your presence tonight and for your attention, I thank you.
You're listening to the Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
There's so much I'd like to talk with you about right now, but if I don't just bring this to an end pretty soon, I'll have to put this podcast aside for yet another day, since my energy level is slipping once again. But I did want to comment on one little historical side note that surrounded the talk we just heard. And that is about the poster that was created by Robert Ross to advertise the event. There were only about 20 of them printed, but today copies of that poster sell for almost $2,000 because it's considered by many to have been the very first psychedelic art poster. And I'll try to post a copy of it along with the program notes for this podcast on our psychedelicsalon.org blog. And, here's one other little tidbit about that night that comes from Robert Greenfield's controversial book about Leary. And since I've read similar accounts of this in other places, I'm fairly confident that it's the truth, but maybe somebody who knows Tom Robbins can verify this for us. Here's what Greenfield had to say about it. One of those who attended Tim's lecture at Cooper Union that night was the novelist Tom Robbins, who had only just come to New York from Seattle, where he had taken LSD while working as an art critic for the Seattle Times. Quote, "Tim's lecture that night influenced the socks I wore for years," Robbins would later say. Tim was wearing red socks, no suit, a white dress shirt. That evening, he spoke a great deal about how LSD alters the genetic imprint. Robbins stopped by a fruit and vegetable stand afterward. "I was going to buy some Brussels sprouts to take home," he would later say, "and Tim was there with a small entourage, getting an apple or something. He had just left the auditorium where Lincoln spoke, and there he was, glowing like a 1,000-watt bulb. I said to him, 'How do you know which Brussels sprouts are good to pick out? Because they all look pretty much the same.' And he said, 'No, no, no. You pick out the ones that are smiling.' The message was received, and so I went home and started wearing red socks." Well, there's a lot more I'd like to say about all that right now, but I'm going to sign off in order to simply get this podcast out to you before you forget about coming back to the salon each week. And in the months ahead, I'm going to try to get more than one program a week out to you in an attempt to catch up with my plan to average at least one program per week during the course of a year. And boy, do I ever have some interesting material for you. My next program is going to be another talk by Terence McKenna, just to provide a little contrast between Tim Leary and Terence McKenna. But I've also got some of the plialogues from last summer's Burning Man Festival and a whole lot more from the Leary Archive. So thanks for hanging in there and waiting for me to get well again. And now that I've finally got this ball rolling once again, I think you'll find the podcast coming out much more regularly. And before I go, I want to mention that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage at www.psychedelicsalon.org. And that's also where you can find the program notes for these podcasts. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.